To quote today's guest, "One thing I have come to realize through this work is just how irresistible humans find it to draw big conclusions about the world from individual experience, and also what makes us incredibly blinkered. Paco Calvo is my kind of scientist. His MINT lab in Spain researches the life and intelligence of plants. His book is Planta Sapiens. Join us. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Paco, understanding the definition of sapiens to mean wise, I think there is a more literal truth to the title of your book, Planta Sapiens, than perhaps us being called Homo sapiens.
Yeah. Well, I guess definitely plants are wise, and definitely we are meant to be all wise one way or another. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, right?
Right.
Any form of life wouldn't be here if it wasn't wise. I guess we just need to be wise enough. We, Homo sapiens, we've got to be wise enough to understand how wise plants are.
Yes, and how wise we can be by looking at nature, certainly, and seeing that whole system. First, let me thank you for challenging the foundations of the human experience and the way humans want to anthropomorphize everything, even God. What skill set or mental activity did you bring in to see a plant on its own terms, or do you think that's possible?
Well, this exercise, intellectual exercise of challenging ourselves to get rid of this gold standard we think we provide, right? That's something we need to do way more often on a regular basis, because it's all over the place. If you think about it, I mean, this attitude, as I speak in the preface of Planta Sapiens, of navel-gazing, we don't realize that we actually navel-gaze around us round the clock. So there is not anything that we don't see through our anthropocentric glasses. And that's really the challenge. I would like to think that it's an attitude or a competence that we can exercise more and more, and with a little bit of rehearsal, we should be able, at the end of the day, to see plants and to appreciate plant intelligence and plant life without those glasses that we wear by default.
Well, you write in your book about the underlying plot and understanding the apparent meaningfulness and intelligence that plants have and that plant behavior reveals, and that requires combining plant science, cognitive science, and philosophy, and that is what your work is about at your Mint Labs. Can you describe this using an example of something you've done?
Yeah, you see, well, first, it's important to understand why we need to combine those disciplines, right? Because if you think of plant science, writ large, the whole botany or the whole plant sciences, by themselves, they are not quite asking the right question. They ask right questions, that's for sure, but not the question we're interested in, Planta Sapiens, plant intelligence, right? And if you talk to psychologists or people within the cognitive sciences, again, writ large, they understand or they think they can throw light upon cognition. Best case scenario, comparative psychology can throw light upon the skills of different animals. But when it comes to unearthing plant intelligence, I find that somehow we are failing to make the right questions. So at Mint Lab, first thing we say is, hold on a sec. If plants are intelligent, whether we are able to appreciate it sometime or not, requires that we think how we come across patterns of intelligence within the animal realm, the animal kingdom, and how we get to understand it. And if you think of animal intelligence first, intelligence in the animal kingdom is not something that you can see directly. You can only infer it, right? Indirectly. The behavior of an animal in the open, wild observations, whatever. But out of their behavior, out of the complexity of their overt behavior, you might guess, okay, this animal has got to be intelligent to some extent, right? So it's only through behavior that we get to conclude that they are intelligent. We just need to do the same with plants. We just need to observe their behavior. If only their behavior unfolds in a temporal scale that is so different from ours, that we need to make an extra effort to appreciate their overt complex behaviors. So what we do is we time-lapse plant behavior. We try to see it, to watch it through footage. We've got to time-lapse them because they are slow, right? That's for sure. But once we see them through time-lapse footage, the time scale in which their behavior unfolds and the time scale of our observations kind of match, converge, and then we are able to see what they're up to. What is it that plants care about? What is it that they are doing in their surroundings? Okay, so that's one tiny window, observing their behavior. Another window we use in our lab is the one provided by electrophysiological activities. Because the very same way we are going to think of our intelligence, again, human or animal intelligence, and we could try to make sense of it through brain correlates, activity in, you know, our brains, we can do something similar in plants. The only difference is that they have no neurons, that's for sure.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they don't have electrical activity.
Right.
So we can record the electrical activity and have those two windows, their overt behavior and the one through the recording of the electrophysiological states with electrodes. So that's the two ways in which we can try to come to terms with their non-neural based intelligence.
Yes. Well, it is interesting that the plant does not have nerves and it doesn't have muscles. So that would, I think, naturally lead you into the electrical currents within the plant. Can you share either an experiment or an observation using the electrical system? And where did that take you? What did that conclude for you?
Yeah, sure. So one of the experimental subjects we are using more often are vines, say climbing beans or any other vine, because their behavior is especially appealing or easy to, in a sense, no, with square quotes, nothing is easy, but easier to observe than in other plant species. So with vines, we certainly have the understanding that they care for a host, maybe a nearby, somewhere that they can, you know, climb onto and grow up there and do photosynthesis. So we know they need to hunt for vines, for supports, for host trees or whatever. With that being said, an overinterpretation of their behavior to think they are constantly hunting because they might be simply growing, and as a result of mere growth, they might bump onto a support. They might bump onto a pole nearby. Oops, I found it. But not intentionally, right? So through electrophysiological recordings, we can check, we can see whether they meant to grow in that direction and reach that pole or that support, or whether that was a cosmic fluke, that was just an accident. I just grew, oh, here I am, lucky me, right? So is there a signature, is there an electrical signature in the activity you are recording that can give you some hint that there is something going on and it's not a mere accident, that they are truly aiming to reach that goal? And that's what we are trying to understand. The data, of course, is still very preliminary. We are way more interested into putting up the theoretical framework. Then we will be able to interpret those results. At the moment, we are working on the framework and gathering, collecting very preliminary data. So we've got to be cautious, but the message is this. This is a way to try to understand through the dynamics, through the kinematics, through the way the patterns of acceleration, the way they grow, how they change the speed of growth, the direction. So we can try to understand how they come to control their pattern of growth. So the working hypothesis is that they are controlling the way they grow directionally to reach the goal they care about.
So have you been able to see, for instance, with the bean plant, when it does reach a goal of a pole that it can actually attach to and then climb further, is there an electrical spark at that moment?
Actually, that's something you can also test, but we are not that interested in the actual spark that might take place when they reach it, because there is a lot of information going on there, sensorially speaking. You know, the other sensory channels open up, like in physical contact, once they are in contact with a pole, with a support. We are more interested in the previous steps, which is when they still haven't started the physical contact with the pole. So when they are still aiming for it, right? So here we can apply the very same metrics, the very same type of measurements that you apply when you are thinking of animal models. Again, the animal-plant dichotomy breaks up because it's just a matter of scale, of temporal scale. But if you forget about the temporal scale, think that plants are neither slow nor fast compared to us. They just are right on.
Yes, so yes.
Their behavior unfolds at the scale it requires. It's only our fault to think that they are slow because we keep ourselves thinking that we provide a standard, right, for comparison. But once we understand that, we can apply the same type of metrics. So we can see complexity, right, in the time series analysis. The same thing you do in cognitive neuroscience. You can check whether there are patterns of complexity or entropy that kind of correlate with episodes, with stages in the pattern of behavior that is unfolding. And that's something you find, measurements related to both complexity and entropy that hint to the very idea of the plant controlling how it's actually growing towards the pole. A different stage is later on, once they touch it and they start twining around, then loading skills and different things are going on, not complex, but different.
Yes. Do you think that plants are using the paths of less resistance? Are they masters at that?
Well, first, there is something important to bear in mind, that when we phrase the question along those lines, we are in a sense falling prey of the type of biases, anthropocentric biases, that we are trying to avoid. Because we say plants, well, which ones? Some plant species, some individuals might do that, less resistance. Others might not, because their target, their tasks, their morphology, the way their plant body develops is different. So there are so many different plants and they have so many different challenges ahead that it's difficult to find a governing rule that fits them all. In some cases, they might employ divide and conquer strategy, very, very unsophisticated. Sometimes the very properties of the environment help you up. In a sense, they provide the solution to the problem and you don't need to crack it up in a very cognitive way. In other occasions, in other circumstances, you might require to do more internal exercise because the environment is not easy to you. So you never know. And then you have the added difficulty that those different plant species might be behaving in very different ways, more or less sophisticated ways, in the open, in the wild. And then when you take those subjects to the lab for the purpose of experimental control, then we are having toy behaviors.
What differences are you seeing? That was one of my questions, if you were able to do any compare and contrast in the differences.
Everything changes so dramatically that it's a joke. It's a joke to pretend to be able to extrapolate and to draw conclusions about their behavior in the open when you are just time-lapsing a single individual into this booth where you have photo period, temperature and relative humidity control, and end of the story. Because many other things are going on in the open. They are constantly communicating with their neighbors, chemical, vibrational, all sorts of cues are bombarding the sensory periphery of the plant. Even when you are having control in the form of photoperiod in the lab, you might be setting time the light or the sun in square quotes, is rising and setting, and you have a period, say 16, 8 hours of light versus darkness. Again, that's a joke. We are not being careful enough about the spectrum, the quality of the light, the amount of red, reddish, bluish at different times of the day. And we know those are crucial cues in plant behavior, right? In the wild.
Yes.
So even the more sophisticated those controls in the lab become, we do use very sophisticated lamps and equipment that allows you to play precisely with properties of the light spectrum. And yet, this is still a very, very, very simplified version of what's out there. If I may take you to another direction, which is similarly related, just to see how complex the challenge is. It's not just a matter of wild versus laboratory observations. It's also a matter of domesticated versus wild species. Because 99.9% of the plants we study in the lab are the result of domestication. The seeds you buy in the nursery or the seedlings, and those guys are the ones we've been domesticating for 10,000 years and counting. And the question is relevant to say, hey, are we, by selecting artificially through agriculture their phenotypes, aren't we altering their behaviors and maybe making them behave more stupidly? Very quick example. Think of the shortening of the internode lengths. So in between two nodes, the length of the stem, that internode length, is being shortened as a result of agriculture in vines, in climbers. That results in being able to explore less widely.
Yes.
Because as that length shortens, they move or they revolve less dramatically. That results in not being able to explore their surroundings as much as their wild counterparts would. So even the type of seeds we are choosing, we need to bear in mind that that's going to have a very strong effect on the potential behaviors we are going to be able to observe.
And you spoke a little bit right now about light. I read in your book about the plants reacting to 5 different spectrums of the light that you've looked at. Do different plant species have different reactions to different spectrums of light? How does that work? How have you seen and what have you seen from that?
Well, again, there is all this literature. We know that different proteins are sensitive to different parts of the spectrum, that's for sure. And some light cues relate, for example, you know, the bluish, it gives you triggers the morning directional cue, get good kickstart. Then we have information that relates not just to different parts of the spectrum, but to the ratios in between them. So the ratio of red to far red, or the ratio of blue to green, those are very, very informative cues. Why? Think that plants will be absorbing the red and the blue, okay? That's why you see them green, that the green is the one get reflected. Same goes for the far red, it goes through or reflects. And that way, those ratios are giving you very, very, very rich information about the density in the neighborhood, in the vicinity. Oh, how many guys are around me, surrounding me, you know, doing photosynthesis? How many guys are there? Because they will be absorbing those parts of the spectrum. And by telling those ratios apart, you can tell which is the most appropriate direction to grow into, provided the needs of yourself, of the individual, right? But it's not just the different parts of the light spectrum. It's how those combine with other cues, chemical cues, acoustic cues, vibrational cues. Take the dodder plant, okay? Cuscuta, the dodder. In the case of these plants, parasitic plants, they cannot do photosynthesis. You know, they need to find a host real soon, early in life, otherwise they are doomed. They need to integrate all those cues real fast. They need to locate the ratios, the blue, the red, the far red, the green. They need to integrate information related to those ratios that is going to be so important in those early stages to find the host that they truly need. And they will be integrating that information together with volatile, with chemical cues being emitted by the host plants, the potential host. On top of that, all this information related to vibrational cues. At the moment, we don't have a clear picture of how all those sensorial cues integrate with one another. We have this tendency to think of plants as simply responding to individual cues, like, oh, blue light, phototropic behavior, or gravity pull, geotropic behavior, as if they were responding on a one-to-one basis to those sources of stimulation, right? And they are not. They are responding to vast panoply of information, both biotic and abiotic. And what's important here is that they need to integrate it all and provide a single response that is globally adaptive to all those cues being combined, not to any of them on a single basis. So things are way more complicated than we can begin to imagine in the lab.
Yes, and that's certainly something that, for me, that is something we can thank science for. The thing I don't want to thank science for is just what you seem to be wanting to combat, thinking that, oh, it's this. We found this. This is the reason. When we're working or looking at nature, there's so much more going on. Like, I really wanted to applaud you, Paco, for acknowledging you can't understand a plant or plant intelligence by cutting the plant up and looking at it or looking at the physiology under a microscope. There's so much more going on. It was also curious, I had heard of the plants in Africa, for instance, these trees, and when giraffes come and they start eating the leaves, the plant will start producing this acidic tasting thing to try and get the giraffes to go away. But also, they have a way of signaling the tree further down the line to say, hey, start producing your acid, the giraffes are coming. And that's a very simplistic way of saying it, of course. But my thinking is, are the trees communicating with each other? Or it's almost like if we're connected to the one, be here now kind of mentality, where we're not going to each other first. First, we're connecting up to whatever that spirit or creator, or if you want to call it God, you know, I don't care what you call it. But in the natural world, there is that essence that is life. So I think it might be more that's what's going on, where once everyone uploads to that origin, that original sense of life and living and survival. So where do you see that? And then also I want to ask you, what is your end? Yes, there is life. What do you want to see as you're going through all of this?
Yeah, wow, whoa, these are big questions, right? No, but I can hear you. Sometimes people are put off by some terminology, and sometimes it's a matter of semantics. Regardless of the way people prefer to frame it, terminologically speaking, one thing is for sure. I entirely agree about the idea of doing away with this mechanistic, reductionist understanding of behavior and planned life, as you mentioned. That's one of my leitmotifs in the book, is to do away with that vision, right? With that being said, I think we need to make an extra effort to distinguish certain patterns that, however sophisticated they are, they belong to evolution itself.
Yes.
So they are adaptations. So sometimes we can speak of some fascinating piece of behavior that we are able to observe, come across in nature, and we need to remind ourselves that, hey, this is great, but this might just be a successful adaptation. We might not need to put the emphasis on the individual as such, saying, hey, how smart you are, but rather, oh, how awesome nature or evolution is, right? One way to draw this distinction and to put the emphasis, to lay the stress on the individual as such, on what you yourself, not just insofar as you belong to the Homo sapiens species, but you yourself or me, myself, what is it that we are doing ourselves that has to do with our life experience,
yes,
right? We might be very well adapted, but on top of that, we might be, you know, slower to learn, faster to learn, have more resources to deal with contingencies. And that takes us to this idea of, are we able to resonate with something that goes beyond those fancy behaviors that we seem to observe, right? I would like to think that regardless of the label we use, that where there is life, there is mind. Mentality belongs to life itself. And by this, I mean life, any form of life whatsoever, because we are talking about plants, but this has to do with life, with bacteria, with cells, with unicellulars. So any form of life whatsoever has got to resonate to be on the same page as this overall energy, force, whatever you call it, right? In that sense, there is a pattern of resonance that either we are able to resonate with, in which case we are on the same page at a more deeper level, or we are just somehow not being able to latch onto those targets. You see what I mean?
Absolutely, so yes.
Here is the idea of we can have the theoretical framework in place, but the difficulty, the challenge resides in being able to put it to the test, to do the empirical, the experimental observations that would allow us to contrast or to test those hypotheses. And that's, to me, the real challenge, how we are able to make this a truly scientific question that can have a scientific answer.
Is there something that you've done research on that has just blown your mind, and or do you have a direction you want to put it in?
Yeah. Well, let's start with the very last question. If you had an end, my view is that you wouldn't be doing science.
Beautiful. Yes. Well said.
This is, yeah, to me, tell my students, I always obsess not with providing answers, but with doing more questions and more questions. Pretty sure we will all retire and we'll have way more questions than answers, right? Now, in terms of if I have found something truly shocking or truly jaw-dropping, this is again something risky, because usually what we find jaw-dropping has to do with the expectations we bring to the observation with our anthropocentric glasses. So why is it that people are in love, I would say, with, you know, the Venus flytrap, Mimosa, the fast guys, because they are fast, because they say, oh, these guys are onto something. Why? Because they do things faster than other plant species, and it's kind of easier for us to appreciate their behavior. So I try to be not so moved with the fast and furious, because I have the feeling that if I can see to the naked eye, I might be fooled by thinking that it's more intelligent than it is, simply because it's closer to us or to our temporal scale.
Yes. Right?
So I try to make an effort to see, to try to visualize these other guys, that the ones that look really dumb because they are way slower, they have nothing to do with our doings or with our hectic lifestyle. Now, if you think of what's going on here, something that I find shocking or something that keeps me, let's say, awake at night, this is something I get started in the book, right? In Planta Sapiens, the idea of putting plants to sleep using anesthesia. Some people are excited about the experiments with anesthesia. Oh, wow, I didn't know you could put plants to sleep. I didn't know you could anesthetize them. Oh, that's so amazing. And again, they are shocked about seeing to the naked eye how a Venus flytrap or a mimosa is not responding, because they know they could have seen a mimosa folding to the naked eye or a Venus flytrap shining to the naked eye, and they don't see it anymore. And they say, well, yeah, sure, the anesthetic is working. And I say, hold on a sec, that's not what should be really intriguing. What's intriguing to me is the fact that a plant, regardless of how fast or how slow it's doing it, at some point, it will come out of anesthesia. So it's not the falling anesthetized, it's the coming out of. If you think about it, what does it mean to come out of anesthesia? In a sense, it means that you are regaining something that you have lost temporarily. Oh, I wasn't aware. I had lost my sense of a subjective experience temporarily. And little by little, the anesthetic wears off, and eventually, I'm back to normal. So if we had lost something and we eventually come back to normal, what does it mean to come back to normal? To regain your subjective awareness. To me, that's what's really awesome, to think that nature, life itself, life, can regain its mindfulness, its mentality, after having been anesthetized. And that is something that happens for any form of life whatsoever, and has to do with those exchanges of ions across the membranes of cells. Effectively, we are preventing a cell from firing an action potential. That's what the anesthetic is doing, right?
Yes, yes.
You're altering those membrane properties, and then there is no exchange of ions, and then there is no possibility of depolarizing or repolarizing a cell. The Venus flytrap or the mimosa is actually not firing an action potential, and that's why it won't fold or it won't snapshot. But plants that are not doing those things to the naked eye also come out of anesthesia,
right?
Also regain awareness. To me, if there is a question, the question is sentient. Any form of nature whatsoever has got to be sentient.
Yes, well, I love all of that. And Paco, I love that your research and you obviously revere and incorporate that open, artful, and emotional focus in your research. I think a true scientist is open to all of these things, like we spoke about earlier, the cognitive, and not just, oh, let's take this brain out of a cadaver and look at it. What's there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We usually throw the baby, no?
Right.
Yeah. We definitely do that all the time. So one thing is for sure, all of us, medical doctors and lay people, all of us, we all need to slow down, to chill out. We have this understanding of science, this idealized vision of science by being objective, by detaching the enterprise from our emotions, our passions, our subjectivity. And that's not possible at all. In fact, we shouldn't be doing that. Doing good science doesn't mean removing the subjectivity into it. Creativity, imagination, that's part and parcel of science. So we have a toy, distorted understanding of science as if it was something that you could, you know, write some code and let an AI do the science for you. And you cannot do that.
Totally agree. And reading your book, Planta Sapiens, I really kept rolling over into the imaginal realm. So you really incorporated that part and parcel. So I thank you for that. All the way from Spain, Paco Calvo. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And we're podcasted where you hope to find us. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.